From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, South African satirist Peter Dirk Ace. He dresses in drag as an opinionated Afrikaner dowager named Evita and interviews the leaders of the new South Africa. Even Nelson Mandela has been interviewed by Evita. Also today, actor David Paymer. In Get Shorty, he plays the dry cleaner who's cashed in on an insurance scam. Paymer co-starred in Quiz Show and was nominated for an Oscar for his performance in Mr. Saturday Night. And Stephen Schiff reviews Persuasion, the British film adaptation of the Jane Austen novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Congress has passed a temporary increase in the government's borrowing authority, but President Clinton says the bill would actually bring a default closer by taking crucial flexibility away from the Treasury Secretary. Mr. Clinton criticized Congress today for failing to pass an acceptable stopgap spending measure to keep the government from shutting down next week, one that's not overloaded with spending cuts and restrictions.
Republicans in Congress have a responsibility to keep the government running without cutting Medicare and increasing premiums, without cutting education and undercutting the environment. I want to work with Congress to resolve these differences and to keep the government running in the interest of the American people.
Congress is not slated to take final action on the stopgap spending bill until Monday afternoon, just hours before government agencies would be forced to shut down. The Bosnian peace talks in Dayton, Ohio, have produced their first agreement, a pact between one-time rival Muslim and Croat communities to form a political and economic union as a first step toward ending the war. At the signing ceremony, Secretary of State Warren Christopher said the accord brings to life the federation formed by the Muslims and Croats under U.S. direction in the spring of 1994. Christopher called the federation an essential building block to peace. The agreement was signed after Christopher met separately with the three Balkan presidents and warned Croatian leaders not to use force to recover eastern Slavonia, the last Serb-held piece of Croat territory. Croatia has sent heavy artillery and hundreds of troops toward the region. GOP frontrunner Bob Dole has picked up another endorsement. Ed Ark from member station WITF has details.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge is the latest to endorse Bob Dole for president. Dole is stumping for votes in the Keystone State today and received the public support when he arrived in Harrisburg this morning. Ridge becomes the 15th of the nation's 30 Republican governors to endorse Dole, overlooking Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Arlen Specter, another hopeful, in the process. Together, Ridge and Dole are making stops at a veterans hospital east of Harrisburg and at a suburban Philadelphia military academy. A later stop in Pittsburgh was canceled to allow Dole to return to the budget impasse in Washington. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Ark in Harrisburg.
The White House has decided not to ask for the resignation of Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary. She was sharply criticized by White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta for spending over $43,000 to have a consulting firm rate news stories and rank reporters covering her department. O'Leary says she considers the matter closed. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up just over 2 points at 4866.39 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up a half a point. This is NPR News. Oklahoma City bombing suspect Terry Nichols has reportedly told an investigator that he might have accidentally helped fellow suspect Timothy McVeigh carry out the bombing by giving him information about fertilizer-based explosives. The Los Angeles Times reports that while Nichols initially insisted McVeigh was not capable of the bombing, he has now concluded otherwise. The blast killed 169 people. McVeigh and Nichols faced the death penalty if convicted. The controversial announcement that the Cleveland Browns football team is moving to Baltimore has prompted a congressional hearing into sports teams changing cities. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
It's not just the plight of Cleveland, says Senator Mike DeWine. Any city with any kind of professional sports team can be a surprise victim of a move out. The Ohio Republican has convinced Strom Thurmond, chair of the Senate Judiciary Antitrust Subcommittee, to hold a hearing on the Browns move and on ideas to make it harder for any team to abandon its home city. DeWine says when a team moves out, it's not just free enterprise in action. Government money is involved, too, so government should have a say.
Stadiums are being built. Hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayers' money are going out the door with no real guarantee that a team is not going to pick up and move in a few years.
The congressional hearing is set for November 29th. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Researchers at St. Louis University and three other medical centers are testing a new form of flu vaccine that would be administered not by shot, but by nasal spray. First tests are being done on young children because they're major carriers of the flu and they shudder at the thought of shots. An earlier study found that flu vaccine given by nose drops is as effective as shots. This new study will compare the spray to drops. If the tests are successful, the flu vaccine spray could be available in 2 or 3 years. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of South Africa's most popular TV interviewers is a man who dresses in drag and appears in the persona as an Afrikaner matron named Evita. Evita's interviewees are the political leaders of the new South Africa. Even Nelson Mandela has been interviewed by Evita. Sounds improbable, doesn't it? But Evita, in between her sometimes dishy asides, manages to evoke genuinely interesting, often moving stories from her guests about their years in exile or in prison, and their hopes for the new South Africa. She's been helping to sell the idea of democracy to resistant Afrikaners. The character of Evita is the creation of South African satirist Pieter Derkes. He spent much of the 70s, 80s, and early 90s satirizing the apartheid regime. The government returned the favor by often censoring his work. But his alter ego, Evita, is popular now in the new National Assembly. In fact, a bust of Evita was recently placed on display in Parliament. Last June, I asked Pieter Derkes to describe Evita.
Evita, firstly, is 10 years older than me. She's 60 this year, and I'm only 50, which is always nice to know. She's got brown hair. She's very... She sometimes feels taller than I am. She sometimes feels thinner than I am, and she's got better legs than I have. But she's very inspired by a great love in my life, who is Sophia Loren. And it's not that she's like Sophia Loren, but Sophia Loren's body language and that extraordinary, eternal confidence that Sophia has physically is something I watch all the time. So Evita has got that inner strength physically, so she's quite imposing. She's got quite a lot of makeup on. She's quite well made up. She's, I suppose, a cross between Imelda Marcos. Who's that lady who ran the hotels? The Helmsley lady?
Leona Helmsley. Yeah.
Margaret Thatcher and Minnie Mouse. I suppose she's a combination of all the strong women that have sort of been around the world, except that Evita is very much her own person. And socially, she was born an Afrikaans girl in the Orange Free State, which is one of the provinces of South Africa. Very much a Calvinist background, very similar to mine. She became the wife of a politician, meaning that she probably was stronger than he was, and eventually overpowered him in her public image. And in fact, in the old South Africa, every time I played her and every time she said, "I've just spoken to P.W. Buerta," the world believed that she had. And the point of my new show with her is that she now says, "I've just spoken to Nelson Mandela," and now they believe that she has too.
What is Evita doing interviewing Nelson Mandela and other luminaries of the new South Africa?
Well, in the old South Africa, she was created in 1978 in a newspaper column I was writing. And because of censorship and because of fear, people were not writing about the things that I thought were, firstly, very absurd, and secondly, very important to hear about. So I created this wife of a nationalist member of parliament who, in the column once a month, would tell the truth, and nobody stopped us. And then I started doing my one-man show, and she became a flesh-and-blood character with a big pink hat and gloves and handbag and all that. And, of course, when Nelson Mandela became my president, I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was irrelevant. I was redundant. I would now become a gardener and work quietly in the garden and stop all this nonsense. But it seems that the new government is writing as much material for me as the old one did. But in order to make Evita pertinent, I had to take her out of opposition, where she's useless, and get her into bed with the new government. And so this new TV series called Evita's Funny Galore had her speaking to 12 of the top new politicians in South Africa. And it was the most extraordinary, surreal experience of my life because, as you can imagine, interviewing Nelson Mandela while wearing a dress and being treated like Margaret Thatcher was something that is difficult to explain.
Now, is this a non-threatening way for Afrikaners to relate to democracy through this character of Evita? They can identify with her and she's preaching democracy. She's preaching the new South Africa.
They can, but they're also aware that she's preaching it through the hypocrisy of the new South Africa. I mean, Evita, like so many white South Africans, is the first person to say that she'd never supported apartheid. Everybody in South Africa was now part of the struggle, which is part of the political Alzheimer's disease that every country in trauma seems to suffer when they come out of it, like Germany in 45. And I mean, I still have to come to the US and find anybody who voted for Ronald Reagan twice, you know. So I think it's a universal problem. But it's not just Afrikaners. I think many other South Africans who are not Afrikaans and white, who are Afrikaans and black, also identify with Evita and take her as a sort of a talisman in their lives.
Do you think that Evita can ask questions that regular journalists wouldn't ask? For instance, to Nelson Mandela, she said, "You've freed all of us, you've freed me of guilt."
Yes, well, the Nelson interview was a very dicey one because Evita's a very bitchy creature, and I made her very one-dimensional. I did not in any way want to embarrass him. I did not want to confuse him with this campery of a man dressed as a woman. I didn't want to trip him up. I mean, I love the man, and the man is too important, a politician, and too precious a human being to trivialize. So Evita behaved herself very much. But there are definitely things that she can say that I can't say.
Like
that
what?
I mean, there are first attitudes that she has that I don't have. She still defends the National Party. She still pretends that apartheid was imported from the United Kingdom and that the Afrikaners gave it the name, but it's a British thing. She's a devil's advocate. And also, because she doesn't exist, means that everybody else can have a ball knowing that they don't exist in that moment in time. So I give people rope and they hang themselves with a smile.
Evita seems to have close personal connections to many of the government leaders she interviews. What are some of the connections you've created for her?
In the past, she had some very specific fax connections with Minister of Foreign Affairs Puk Buerta, and with the Minister of Police and with various other cabinet ministers, whom I personally have never met. But eventually, the letters that she wrote to them were answered to her. And the only minister from that stable that I still play with is Minister Puk Buerta, who is now a recycled nationalist in the government of Mandela. And in the legend of Evita, she's had an affair with him for 27 years. And the irony is that he now believes it. So in my interview with Puk Buerta, he hugged Evita like hugging an old mistress. He called her my darling, my sweetheart. I mean, I call him Mr. Minister and he calls me Peter, you know, like some school teacher. But Evita calls him sweetheart and he calls her darling. And I tell you, yes, I think some psychiatrists could write thick books about this relationship.
Peter Dirk Ace is my guest. He's a South African satirist. And he hosts a very popular TV show in South Africa in which he dresses in drag as an upper-class Afrikaner matron, named Evita. And in that persona, he interviews Nelson Mandela and other leaders of the new South Africa. I understand Nelson Mandela once invited Evita to an election rally. Did Evita go? And what was it like?
Well, that was my first step into the new arena. I was asked to come and entertain 40,000 black, mainly black kids and young people from the townships at a rally that Nelson was giving in the Cape. And I took Evita wearing her traditional Afrikaner outfit. It was like doing Fiddle on the Roof in Nuremberg. It was the most extraordinary experience, I'll tell you. I was very nervous because I really didn't know if these people knew what I was doing because I was very much a white icon through a white media of television and theater, which was not something that all black people were interested in. And yet, the moment Evita arrived on stage, she was cheered like you would cheer somebody at a basketball game. So I did my 15 minutes, and basically my message to the people was the vote is secret. No matter who you vote for, nobody will know, because the big fear was that people would be punished for whoever they voted for. And then Nelson arrived, and I was asked to remain there as Evita. I wanted to go to the loo. I needed to go and have a wee. I mean, I'd been dressed as a girl for long enough. I needed to do something boyish. But they said, no, sit. Nelson wants to meet you. So eventually I ended up sitting next to Nelson, gazing at him like Nancy Reagan. And it was wonderful. And every time he looked at Evita, he roared with laughter. And if there's any contribution I can make to the health and the happiness of Nelson Mandela is to allow him to laugh as much as he likes at Evita. If that's all I'm there for, then I've done my job.
Well, would you do Evita's voice for us to give our listeners a sense of the character?
Well, thank you. I'm so glad you have a chance to talk to the Americans who have done so much to inspire us in the past. You know, I came to America in the 50s with my husband. We were sent to America by Dr. Verwoerd to study your Indian reservation system on which we based our homelands policy. So I have a very soft spot for you Americans. So there she is.
At the end of the show, Evita sometimes blows kisses to the audiences.
Oh, absolutely. She blows kisses to Nelson Mandela in her cell phone. She speaks to him all the time and tells him to put in his eye drops. She says, now remember, Madiba, it's 2 eye drops every 4 hours, not 4 every 2. Otherwise, your eyes go blue. We don't want a black president with blue eyes.
My guest is South African satirist Peter Dirk Ace, who hosts a South African talk show in persona as Evita. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Peter Dirk Ace is my guest. He's a South African satirist who dresses in drag as an upper-class Afrikaner matron named Evita, and in that persona he interviews Nelson Mandela and other leaders of the new South Africa. Tell us how you first created Evita. She goes back a long time.
Yeah, she goes back to the late 70s when things were getting darker and darker. P.W. Botha had just taken over as prime minister. And I couldn't get a job because I'd had all my plays banned by the censor board. So somebody gave me a job as a columnist in a Sunday newspaper. And through this column, I created the wife of a nationalist member of parliament who could then tell things that were really happening that nobody would write about. So that's what she started as a means to an end. And then when I started my one-man show, political show in 1981, she was a character in the chorus line. And because dressing up as a woman, as an Afrikaner, is very controversial in South Africa, she attracted a lot of attention. And soon I built up a whole family history for her. She has a husband, she has children, whom I play as well. She has twin sons. One's very butch and very Nazi. His name is Izan, which is Nazi spelled backward. And her other son is very gay and very, very very sweet and sensitive. And her daughter's name is Billie Jean, very blonde, very Sharon Stone. And she married, now in the new South Africa, she's married to a black man and she's got black children. So Evita Besaidnet has got black grandchildren, which serves her right.
Well, did the censors in South Africa during apartheid see your sexual anarchy, the gender bending, as particularly threatening?
No, I don't think so. I think they saw it as extremely irritating. They called me terribly, terribly potent names like homosexual, like communist, like anti-Afrikaans, like anti-South African. Wonderful words that actually really mean nothing other than just to enrich one's resolve. So it really wasn't. Listen again. Let me just underline the fact that I was not in any way in as much danger as most of the South Africans who were tortured to death, who were shot, who were imprisoned, who were banned. You know, I think my high-heeled shoes and my stuffed bra and my red lips helped me survive.
And when the censors called you homosexual, what kind of weight did that have? Is that a terrible thing to be called by censors?
Well, for many years it was a terrible thing until we got our new constitution, which now protects gay rights. It's the only one in the world that does. But in the past, it was illegal. It was against the law to be homosexual and to even admit to things like that. Many times when I was confronted with the accusation of Was I homosexual? I would say, yes, I am homosexual on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Mondays and Wednesdays, I'm heterosexual. On Friday, I'm bisexual. And on Saturdays, I use my imagination like Hugh Grant.
And now, I've read that in one of your plays, during the era when a lot of your work was being censored, you made up an obscenity, a fake word.
Yes.
That you used as an obscenity. What? And then you called, I think, the censorship board and invited them out to watch your play.
Well, that happened because one of the great things that happened to me is I had a great father, great sense of humor, a very, very strict Calvinist conservative man, but a man with a great sense of humor. And I got him onto the censor board right in the middle of all my trouble with the censor board. My pa became a censor. Because he could see movies free. He loved the idea of seeing movies uncut and free. And he's the one who said, these people are such idiots. Learn the law. Learn the law and trap them with their own law. So the law says, and still does strangely, even now, they haven't bothered to get around to getting rid of that law yet, that if they have one complaint, they must come and ban. So I used to complain. I used to send them three or four different letters with different letterheads and different pens complaining about my work. So they would come and ban my work, and I would reproduce the letters and say I was responsible for my own censorship, and then that would get great publicity. So sadly, I frightened them away. But then in one play, instead of using really rude words, I made up Afrikaans words to sound rude, and they banned that play. And then in the little court case we had to try and get the play back, we exposed them for not actually knowing their swear words. And the publicity was more than money could buy. And that made the people laugh at the fear of censorship. And that was also very positively undermining of the system.
What are the words that you made up, the fake Afrikaner swear words?
Well, there was this word that sounds like this, genotskrots. Doesn't it sound rude? Genotskrots. I mean, it sounds like something like a crotch that gives joy, which, of course, it doesn't mean a thing, but it's genotskrots. It was wonderful. And they had to look it up in their dictionary, and they couldn't find it, and they were very embarrassed.
So this was like a little performance piece you created, in a way.
Yes. I mean, you know, everything was part of the whole. Everything meant that no matter, even if you were... If you knew you were breaking the law, you had to make them aware of the fact that you knew that you were breaking the law. In some of my shows, I would have a pre-printed postcard addressed to the Minister of the Interior, in which the postcard said, I hereby find this show obscene, blasphemous, blah, 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 delete whichever word is not applicable. And they would just post these in their thousands to the minister and just clog his postal passages and cause unnecessary chaos and hope, fully put up the blood pressure and made people laugh at their bosses. Laughter is a great weapon. You know, people find it very hard to fight it.
So I guess the trick for you is every time one of your plays was banned, you had to come up with another play.
Well, you see, the reason I did these one-man shows was because I was in charge of the material. There was no script because they could ban it from the script. That's what the law said. If there's no script, they had nothing to work from. I could also change it every night. I changed the title. If they came and banned the title, I'd have another title. And also, I'd have three or four cardboard boxes on stage with all my props in and all my characters, not going off stage to change, changing in front of the audience, which gave it a very unique theatricality. And when the show was over, I threw my boxes in the back of the little car and raced off before the audience could catch me.
Has your family always been behind you as a satirist?
My family was very closely related to the first Afrikaner apartheid prime minister. My family is very Afrikaans rooted from my father's side, and a great family. I love them. They're very fine people. And the way that we have as a family adapted to the alphabet of democracy is a remarkable example of how South Africa has done it. Because my family was very conservative. But my mother was Jewish. My mother was from Berlin. She'd been thrown out by the Nazis, and she brought with her this great humor, this great compassion, this great anger, and this great survival that the Jewish nation has had for millions of years, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm very proud to be a Jewish Afrikaner. I belong to both chosen people.
Have you done satires of Winnie Mandela?
Yes, I do Winnie. She's my superstar. I mean, Winnie is really very important in my show. I've done her for some years. In fact, I even did her in an airport lounge when she sat next to me and she said, darling, do that sketch you do about me. And let me tell you, it was very hard, except she laughed. I'd never understood why she laughed, but she thought it was funny. Yes, I do, Winnie. I do, Winnie.
What are some of the things you have to say about her?
Well, Winnie's the one who gave me the title for the new show. At one stage, she says, she's got this fantastic Afro outfit on, and she says, "Do you like my new outfit? I got it in New York when I was there raising money for the IDP. The shop gave it to me free after I took it. Oh, come now, darling, fair is fair. We watched whites bankrupt our country. Now it's going to be our turn. Baby, you ANC nothing yet." So she's a very sexy, dangerous lady to play with. And she's a major South African politician. So absolutely, she's very much in my show.
You know, you mentioned Desmond Tutu. I understand you do a very good caricature of him.
Thank you, yes. Yes, you know, I said to Peter Dirk, I said, "Why am I not in your show?" And so he did me in his show, and I went to look at him, and, you know, I said, "You know, it's very good, you're very naughty, but you don't wear enough rings on your fingers."
Did he really say that to you?
He said that to me, and he gave me some more rings, and I've got at least 12 rings on my 10 fingers. I love him, I love him, he's a great man.
Vita sounds like she's a real big hit with the new government and with many people in South Africa today. But are there people who are really angry at the character and who really hate the work that you're doing now?
Yes, yes, I'm delighted to tell you that there are. And that's wonderful. That's democracy, the right to disagree. I always find that such a vehement reaction against such a flimsy character tells me more about the people than the character. I mean, I've had critics, you know, say to me, "Stop this nonsense, you know, do something serious." And then I find out that they dress up as Evita when they're at home.
Peter Dirkace is a South African satirist. He's currently touring his one-man show, You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. Our interview was recorded last June. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
J'examine et je fulmine. Moi la carabine, ça me dit. Mais vous, je vous ai là. Ma poitrine, je m'incline. Je vous fais signe. Je vous dis. Brrrr la cat 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 que dit. Brrrr la cat 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 que dit. Brrrr la cat 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 que dit. Couponne ça ma pendo, couponne ça ma pendo. Nani saïdia, nani saïdia. Na tout saïdia bataton, batoto, batoto.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor David Paymer. In the new film Get Shorty, he plays the dry cleaner who's presumed dead but is actually cashed in on an insurance scam. He also played the rigged game show host in the film Quiz Show. And Stephen Schiff reviews the British film adaptation of the Jane Austen novel Persuasion. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There are so many nooks and crannies in the recorded history of the blues, it's hard for anyone to know all of them. Sometimes rare records with exalted reputations can turn out to be dull, while material that's reputedly trivial can look a lot better under closer examination. That's what critic Milo Miles discovered when he listened to a new collection of recordings by Chicago bluesman J.B. Lenore.
Oh God, if you can hear my prayer now, my brothers over in Vietnam. Oh Lord, if you can hear my prayer now, please help my brothers over in Vietnam. The poor boys fighting, killing high and all in hole. Maybe killing their own brother they do not know. Mr. President, you always cry about peace.
The conventional wisdom is that the blues offers only indirect political protest, but there are many blistering exceptions to that notion. And one performer, J.B. Lenore, almost specialized in angry broadsides on current events. I mean, this guy recorded Korea Blues in 1951 and Eisenhower Blues in 1954, right in the teeth of the so-called silent generation. On the other hand, some conventional wisdom about J.B. Lenore himself now seems to be a little off base to me. He isn't well known today, at least in part, because he died shortly after a car accident in 1967 when he was only 38. The standard line about him is that his sharp sides are recorded first for the J.O.B. label, then Parrot Records, and finally for Chess Records. Practically all that he left, other than those, are a couple of sessions done with bassist and producer Willie Dixon. These were issued only on the French L&R label, and they weren't supposed to be much. Now the L&R sides are available on the domestic Evidence label. They are pretty stark, sound more like experiments than finished tracks, but they grow on you. The L&R collection on Evidence is called Vietnam Blues, and it's kind of a complicated case for a reviewer. I would still say that anyone unfamiliar with Lenore should start with Chess and J.O.B. recordings, like Mojo Boogie and Talk to Your Daughter, and the Korea and Eisenhower numbers. But I can't say anymore that you would really know him without the L&R cuts. Sure, he does remakes of a bunch of tunes, including Mojo Boogie and Talk to Your Daughter, and he recycles melodies shamelessly. But Lenore was a restless guy, and many of the tracks on Vietnam Blues have a strange undercurrent of serious funk as well as serious protest. If Lenore had lived, these recordings indicate he could have taken off with a potent progressive blues hybrid. This is no more than a tantalizing speculation, of course, but it's fun to wonder about. And I'm going to keep Vietnam Blues next to other very simple, very provocative collections like Hank Williams's Just Me and My Guitar.
Milo Miles reviewed Vietnam Blues, a collection of the music of J.B. Lenore on Evidence.
Turn to the beat. goddamn job and act well crazy. The voodoo music gonna knock them crazy. The voodoo. The voodoo. The voodoo music got the whole world on a go.
Coming up after David Paymer, this is Fresh Air. My guest David Paymer is one of the stars of the film Get Shorty. He plays a dry cleaner who cashes in on an insurance scam but remains a real loser. Paymer won an Academy Award nomination for his role in Billy Crystal's movie Mr. Saturday Night. He worked with Crystal in City Slickers and its sequel. You can also see Paymer in the film Quiz Show, which is now out on video. Quiz Show is about one of the biggest scandals in TV history, the revelation in 1958 that the game show 21 was rigged. Contestants were sometimes provided with the questions before airtime. David Paymer played the producer of the Quiz Show. I spoke with him when Quiz Show was released in October of last year. Here's a scene from the movie in which Paymer, as producer Dan Enright, tells contestant Herb Stemple, played by John Turturro, that it's time for him to throw the game.
You lose when I tell you to lose.
Oh. It's an arrangement. It's always been an arrangement.
If you told me to lose before, if you told me to lose right from the beginning, then I'd understand. That'd be the story of my life. But why now? What did I do?
Look at the big picture. It's not like television is going to go away, you know? I mean, think about the future.
You mean like a panel show?
Yeah, check. Now, the last category is movies. We're going to ask you what won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1955. You don't know it? You answer on the waterfront.
Oh, no. Oh, no, don't do that. Not Marty. I saw Marty 3 times. The best picture from 2 years ago, and I don't know it?
Someone of your intellect, and it's such a simple question. Don't you see the drama of that?
Drama?
Herb, don't do this to yourself.
Please, let me lose on a physics question. Not Marty, Dan. Don't do this to me. It's too humiliating.
For 70 grand, Herb, you can afford to be humiliated.
Although game show producer Dan Enright sounds like the villain of the story, actor David Paymer told me he didn't play it that way.
You know, Dan Enright, what he was really concerned about was ratings and putting on a dramatic show. And I even watched interviews with him in his later years, and all he would talk about was drama. We wanted drama. And he was really following a long tradition of rigging, or the euphemism, I suppose, was controlling these quiz shows that dated back to the 40s in radio. And, you know, Dan Enright was trying to create a dramatic show, and in a way he thought that he was educating the country. And I sort of took that tack as an actor, that my character felt he was doing a good thing for the country, that he was sort of opening up education and knowledge and intellect for the school children of America. So I played him as a college dean, mm-hmm. not as the bad guy.
Did you ever watch any of the game shows that Dan Enright produced?
Yeah, Robert Redford gave us these kinescopes of the original shows of 21, a lot of the shows that are depicted in the film. And it's quite fascinating to watch these contestants in retrospect. Some of them were very good actors, actually. But then again, some of them, when you watch it now, it's almost laughable. And you wondered, you know, why didn't the American public realize they were being duped? Because they'd ask questions like, what was the name of Paul Revere's horse? And then these contestants would be like, let me think. I mean, a question like that, usually either you know it or you don't. And they're taking all this time and really being dramatic, like Enright told them to. And some of it looks quite fake.
Of course, so much on TV from that period looks fake to us now.
Well, that's true, I guess. And I suppose, it's a testament to the power of the medium, of that very new medium at the time,
that when people saw it coming over the airwaves, they just believed it, you know?
Though I have to say, you know, like Wheel of Fortune isn't exactly verite. You know, I mean, guishas have never looked exactly real.
Right, right. But I guess it's really the line that Scorsese says in the movie when he says, Scorsese, playing one of the sponsors, says, well, the quiz shows will be back. They're just going to have to ask easier questions because the American people, really, they don't care about the questions or the answers. They're just following the money. And, well, Jeopardy's sometimes difficult, though, isn't it?
Yeah, right. It is.
At least if you play double Jeopardy.
Now, what did you do to get the look of the era?
Yeah, and what a look. talk about unflattering.
Didn't like those glasses?
Someone said to me after seeing me, gee, Dave, you have absolutely no ego at all. It's so great. I mean, you know, what does that mean? Well, I know what it means. Well, you know, Dan Enright didn't have the greatest hairstyle in the world. And actually, Redford suggested a hairpiece for me, which is really not flattering at all because it's sort of that bacon strips, you know, combed, you know, brought over from the side, and it looks terrible. And then these dark glasses, sort of like the Steve Allen glasses of the 50s, but really thick, which is what Enright wore back then, too. So I was looking at a lot of pictures of Enright, and, you know, it's not really my... it's not really my choice of a way to look, but I think it worked for the role.
What was it like to work with Robert Redford as your director? Do you think he has any insights by virtue of having worked as an actor for so many years?
Oh, absolutely. You know, Redford is absolutely an actor's director. And by that I mean he knows how to speak with actors. He knows how to talk with them. He knows how to communicate what it is he needs in a scene. I like to say that Redford knows the actor's secret handshake. He can just say a word or two and make you understand what he's talking about.
What's one of those words he said to you that helped?
Well, for me, it was economy. I can be sort of like a nervous guy, a little neurotic, a deal of anxiety here sometimes. And when I started rehearsing Enright, I was sort of moving my hands a lot while I was talking and trying to convince Van Doren, for instance, to go on the show, or the rigged show. And Redford said to me, you know, there's an authority thing, Dave, and it's just economy. It's just not moving around so much in your seat, not using the hands so much. And if you watch my performance, there's a stillness to it that is very different from a lot of the other roles I've played.
Mm-hmm.
And in that stillness comes authority, and it really worked for me. I mean, it's amazing. It's hard to just sit still because you've got all this nervous energy as an actor, but Redford showed me a way to kind of rein that in, and it worked very well for the character.
Actor David Paymer is my guest. The character you played on Mr. Saturday Night, it seems like the opposite side of the coin from the character that you play in Quiz Show. You look similar in terms of like the eyeglasses and everything in both roles. It's the same period. But in Mr. Saturday Night, you're always getting taken advantage of. And in Quiz Show, you're the one taking advantage of others.
Right. Isn't that beautiful?
You know, what goes around comes around.
Yeah, I love when that happens. That's one of the reasons that I was so attracted to the role of Dan Enright, because it was so different. And I think after Mr. Saturday Night, maybe people were thinking, gee, that, you know, that David Paymer, he's such a mensch, you know, he's such a nice guy. I have read for some, quote, bad guys in the past 2 years, and I haven't got the parts. So I hope that people are seeing the dark side of David Paymer. And, you know, maybe this will open up a new range for me.
You've told us a little bit about how you carried yourself, that whole economy of motion, in a power role. In Mr. Saturday Night, when you're somebody who's being taken advantage of by your brother, how do you carry yourself differently? How do you use your voice differently?
Well, a lot of Mr. Saturday Night was listening because, I mean, I learned early on when Billy and I were doing some improvs and stuff in rehearsal that it's pretty hard to top Billy when you're improvising, you know? And I felt a little inadequate in trying to come up with jokes that were as funny as Billy's. And I said that to Billy early on, and he said to me, "That's perfect." And I said, "Why?" He said, "That's how Stan feels." You know, Stan always wants to be as funny as Buddy, and he wants to be in front of the audience, but he doesn't quite have it. So I used that reality in terms of how I felt, not being a stand-up comic, trying to sort of, you know, verbally spar with Billy. And also, I don't know, I just had there was a lot of emotional stuff from my childhood and from my own relationship with my brother that I used in Mr. Saturday Night as well.
Well, you and your brother used to do a comedy act together.
Yes, we did.
What kind of act was it?
Not very good.
What else was it like?
Well, it was actually when we first moved to L.A. I'm very close with my brother, Steve. He's a comedy writer. And we used to... He played at Merv Griffin, and I would be Sylvester Stallone, and I would be Nicholson, and we'd do all these impressions. And, you know, we soon found that it wasn't really for us. I mean, being a comedian is kind of like being a salesman. And I don't think I would be a very good salesman, you know, talking people into buying things that they don't really want. I'm not very good at that. And a comedian is like, well, you know, I got these jokes. Do you want to buy them? Do you like them? You don't like them. You're not buying. And it felt like that a lot. So I sort of stuck with acting, and my brother went into writing. I've done some writing as well, but more recently it's been mostly acting for me.
Is your father in show business?
Well, he is, actually. He's a musician, and he also has a doctor of musicology. He went back to school later in life, and but he's a very talented pianist and a composer. And you know, when my brother and I were kids, my parents used to put on shows that they wrote and directed and produced on Long Island. Community shows. And I'm from Oceanside, Long Island, and my folks wrote a show called Oceanside USA, and they did it to raise money for the public library and stuff like that. And I can remember when I was 5 or 6 years old sitting in the front row and seeing my dad like conducting this little orchestra he put together, and my mom on stage acting. And so, gee, I guess it was in the blood, you know.
You started off in musicals, didn't you, as an actor? I know you were in Grease. I know that was one of your early big breaks.
Yeah, that was really my first break, the show Grease. And I did, you know, I did all the musical comedies back in high school. That was the big thing. I suppose it still is in most high schools.
So did you like Grease?
It was a great experience. It's, you know, it's a fun show, and I was 21 years old, mm-hmm. and I was just out of college, and I walked into an open call. And I got the part, and I did the national touring company, and then they sent me to Broadway within a year. And it was like, it was a dream come true. I mean, that to this day, that's the most important job I ever got in show business, because I wasn't the type of person or actor who would have stuck it out for like 10 years or 12 years waiting tables. I don't think I had the constitution for that, and I was very lucky to have a measure of success at such a young age.
We know between Grease, Mr. Saturday Night, and Quiz Show, a lot of your roles have been in the 1950s.
I know. It's weird. I mean, I, you know, I was reading some of the notices on Quiz Show, and one of them said, you know, and David Paymer, who has, you know, this quintessential 1950s face.
No, what does that mean?
I have no idea. You know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm glad because it's worked out.
Have you gone back and looked at family photos from the 50s to see what your family looked like back in the period that you've been playing?
Well, yeah, and I mean, especially my dad, because he, you know, he, just the hair and that whole look, it just, I don't know, it seems like almost artificial now, but it's, you know, it's, that's the way people were. Also, for Enright, there was sort of a, actually had gained a little weight for Enright because there was sort of a softness to these guys. You know, these guys weren't working out. They were smoking and drinking, and I don't think they took very good care of themselves. And you can look back at the 50s, and these guys who were relatively young really look kind of puffy. So I was going for that at the time.
I have, in my mind, cast you in two different roles in movie biographies. One is a biopic of George C. Scott, the early years.
Thank you.
And the other is George Mitchell, the early years. I don't know why.
I play him when he's baseball commissioner?
Right. But this is in your 1950s guys with those glasses.
Yeah, right.
Right? I mean, not you as yourself. Actually, I've never seen you as yourself.
That's
in New York and I'm in Philadelphia, so
I have
no idea what you look like out of character.
I look much better than I do on, I'm telling you. I have no ego whatsoever in my film roles. And I don't wear glasses. This is what's killing me.
Not at all? Not even contact lenses?
It's killing me. No, I don't wear glasses. And yet, in many of my screen roles, I wear glasses. I don't know. I'm going to have to stop doing that.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I thank you a lot.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
David Paymer recorded in October of 1994. You can see him in the new film Get Shorty and in Quisha, which is now out on video. Coming up, a review of the new film Persuasion. This is Fresh Air. Started a few years ago when E.M. Forster's novels began getting adapted by David Lean, and then by Merchant and Ivory, and then by all the Merchant Ivory imitators in sight. Then it was Edith Wharton's turn, and now movie makers are taking a good look at Jane Austen. Emma inspired the summer hit Clueless, and a truer adaptation is also being made. Emma Thompson's version of Sense and Sensibility is on its way, too. But first there's the BBC's production of Austen's last novel, directed by Roger Mitchell. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Persuasion.
In a way, Mitchell and his screenwriter, Nick Deere, have made an anti-Merchant and Ivory Austen movie. The sun doesn't often shine on this English countryside, and when it does, its light is not so much golden as ghastly white. The costumes look lived in, and even muddy around the edges, and the fair maidens on hand are not all that fair. Several of them don't even quite look clean. Persuasion is Austen's novel of hopeless longing and passion delayed. It's not bright and sprightly like Pride and Prejudice or Emma, and its heroine, Anne Elliot, is more saddened and repressed than the Jane Austen heroines we're used to. That's especially true in this movie version, because Anne, played by Amanda Root, is plain-looking and furtive during the first half of the movie, that is, before the filmmakers finally let her blossom. Anne's problem is that she's afraid she's destined to be an old maid, not that she hasn't known love. When she was younger, she was ardently wooed by Frederick Wentworth, a dashing, handsome, good-hearted man. The trouble was that he came from an undistinguished family, and Anne's family is distinguished and snobby and surrounded by other snobs, like Lady Russell, who turns out to have been the key persuader in Persuasion. It was she who convinced Anne to spurn Wentworth. But now, many years later, a certain admiral is renting out Anne's family mansion, and it turns out that that admiral is married to Wentworth's sister. So Wentworth returns. And this time, he's not just a poor suitor, he's a Navy captain. The Napoleonic Wars have made him rich. But does that mean that Anne can just up and marry him? Afraid not. There's too much pride and too much prejudice in the way. For one thing, everybody keeps trying to fix Anne up with her patrician cousin, William Elliot. And for another thing, Lady Russell is still around, making trouble. As in this scene, in which poor, frustrated Wentworth confronts Anne and later Lady Russell herself.
I have a commission from my admiral, and I must discharge it, though you may think me impertinent. But remember, I speak for him. The admiral is aware that everything is settled for a union between Mr. Elliot and yourself. It has occurred to the admiral that when you are married, it might be your wish to return to Kellynch Hall. And I have been charged to tell you that if this should be what you wish, the admiral will cancel his lease and that he and my sister will find themselves another place. There, I've done my duty. Do you wish it? All you have to do is give me a yes or a no, and we are both released.
The admiral is too kind, but...
Just say it. Yes or no.
Why is everyone assuming that...
Captain Wentworth.
Lady Russell.
You have an extraordinary ability to discompose my friends, sir.
You have an extraordinary ability to influence her, ma'am, for which I find it hard to forgive you.
That's Charon Hines as Wentworth and Susan Fleetwood as Lady Russell. And like virtually everyone else in the movie, they're both terrific. In fact, Persuasion is full of wonderful British stage and TV actors you've never heard of. This isn't a glamorous production, and it may be too gritty and unkempt for some tastes, but it's also very beautifully made. The filmmakers build their story slowly and carefully, starting from a portrait of a squalid and decayed aristocracy that's downright chilling and spiraling upward toward an unlikely but wildly romantic climax in the surreal streets of Bath, England. Except for that climax, nothing has been prettied up for contemporary audiences. None of the language has been reduced, and what you get is something that feels as heady and strong as black tea, with a surprising emotional tug. A lot of people these days are saying that American television is better than ever, but Persuasion was made for British television. And watching it with that in mind, you can't help thinking we have a long way to go.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Well, it's time for another dreaded goodbye. For the past year, Nancy Updike has worked with us part-time editing interviews. It makes you feel lucky to work with someone who can make your interviews sound good and make you laugh. I hate to say goodbye, but this is no time for me to whine. Nancy's moving to Chicago to a full-time job at a new national show produced by the great Ira Glass, and we can't wait to hear it. I'm Terry Gross.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. Bet your bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago. Chicago, the town that Marty Faye could not shut down.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, presenting Blues Fest, Modern Blues of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, a collection of contemporary blues artists including B.B. King, Robert Cray, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.